Hey, what's up, everybody? Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Left to Be Talk. Today is Monday, March 5th. How are you guys? How was your weekend? Did you watch the Oscars, the Academy Awards? Did you see the winners and losers? Yeah, man. People knock the Academy Awards. I don't know what it is, but I've watched it all my life, and I'm into it, you know? That's just some weird thing about me. I enjoy movies, and I know the hard work that it goes into making them, and I know acting is crazy hard. You know, sometimes you look at something, you go, I could do that, and then, you know, I said that for years, and then I've done some movies and TV, and you're like, oh. I mean, you know, I'm not talking about like De Niro, Raging Bull type acting where it's just next level. Of course, I don't sit there and watch that and just think, oh, I can do that. But I'm talking when you're watching sitcoms and all that, you're like, ah, I got this, you know, or even, you know, small indie movies. I could play a biker, no problem. And then you get on the set and you're like, oh, man, this is, you know, this is something. It's definitely, it is not easy. And so hats off to the industry for, you know, all your work out there that we enjoy. People shit on Hollywood all the time, but then they sit there and watch TV the whole time, which is hilarious to me. Just, oh, yeah, fuck those Hollywood people, those liberals. And then they're saying that as they just, you know, flipping through the channels going, man, I love this show. So anyway. Welcome. Just a little rant there. I want to give a shout out to all the donators here. I missed them last week because I was just such a blur from the thin wall apartment, and the donations are so important to the show. And I just absolutely cannot thank all of you enough. Everybody that's donated to Patreon, it helps, man. It helps. This show is a lot of work to do. I have no assistants. I have no producers, nothing. It's all me, 100%. I book the guests. I record the shows. I edit the shows. I post the shows. So it's crazy work, and it's much appreciated. Want to give a shout out to Mark Parker. Awesome. Great donation. Another Mark Brunot, an Australian mate. I always love that when you see people from other parts of the world that are listening to the podcast. You know how fucking insane that is to think something I started in my one-bedroom apartment, somebody from Australia's listening to, or Hong Kong, or I got people listening in Egypt, all over the place, so... That just blows my mind. Mark Brunot, thank you. Brian Spink, thank you so much. Brian Spink, a Patreon pledge. Ewan McCurrick, thank you so much. Another, and these are some solid donations. I cannot thank you enough. And it's just blowing my mind, the support I get from you. You Dell Razors, the 1,000 true fans. The Dell Razors, the crew. Alex Lazoya. Alex Lazoya, thank you so much. And also I want to give a big, big shout out to a man who helps me with all my flyers, Joe Saltarelli. Thank you so much for just crushing it all the time at last minute with the flyers, you know. I don't think you get enough glory. I need to give you more glory. So you are a king with the Instagram posters. The Photoshop work you do is next level. And thank you for the newest poster, which I just got. I just posted up for the Bon Scott tribute. Who's coming to that? April 3rd. There's only 109 tickets left, and we are a month away from the show. So I'm going to give you a heads up. If you think you're going to get in waiting the last minute, you are crazy. This show will sell out. If you don't know what it is, it's my Bon Scott tribute I'm doing at the Avalon Theater across the street from Capitol Records, the old Palace Theater. This show is absolutely insane. It's going to be comedy, full comedy show with Bill Burr, Mark Maron, Joey Diaz, and myself doing comedy for the first hour and a half. Then the next hour and a half will be an all-out tribute to Bon Scott with Burr playing drums, Marin playing guitar, me singing, Josh Z from Protein on guitar, Nikki Six, Scott Ian has just been added from Anthrax, Greg Dooley, Dave Kushner from Velvet Revolver, Michael Devin, my right-hand man, you know him from hosting the podcast with me, Rudy Sarzo, Jesse, and Dave from Eagles of Death Metal. How cool is that? Steve Gorman will be on the drums, an absolute dream drummer to get for this gig from the Black Crowes, of course. Who else we got? We got Chris Goss from Masters of Reality. Unbelievable. Billy Rowe from Jet Boy and a bunch of other secret stuff are going to happen. Come down April 3rd. Do not sleep. Ticket links are in my Twitter feed, of course, and on my website, deandelray.com. Other gigs coming up, just added, May 3, 4, and 5, Punchline in San Francisco. I will be coming to you, San Fran, the hometown return. Nashville, doing the Ryman Theater, two nights with Bill Burr, April 20th and 21st. Buffalo this week. Buffalo coming your way. Steve Renazzisi and I will be at Helium 8, 9, and 10. And then the entire month of March, pretty much most of it, I will be at The Stand in New York City and two shows in Nyack on the March 21st, Nyack Levity Live. That's going to be insane. All these great shows. And of course, Arizona House of Comedy. Tickets are for sale right now, May 17th through the 20th. I'll be headlining. And Irvine Improv headlining one night, April 11th. All right, got that business out of the way. Let's talk a little bit about the guest. The guest today is absolutely next level. He is Colin Hanks. My guest is the great Colin Hanks. And I'll tell you what, Colin has made two of the greatest documentaries I've seen in years. He is an absolute solid human. And I listened back to this episode today, and it's definitely one of my favorite conversations I've had in a long time. I loved it. We talk about his Tower Records documentary called All Things Must Pass, The Rise and Fall of Tower Records. That came out in 2015. If you have not seen it and you are a vinyl or music freak, this is a must. Also, he did the incredible, moving, and just beautiful, beautiful documentary, Eagles of Death Metal, Our Friends. And that is a very, very, very touching film. And I cannot say enough about what a great job he did on both these documentaries, man. And of course, you know him from all his work on TV and films. He is an absolute, he's out there just in the game, working like a madman. So I think you're going to love this. We talk all kinds of stuff. We talk music, of course. We talk growing up in Sacramento. He's a California kid. And we talk about hard work paying off. Colin, I can't thank you enough for doing it, and what a great guest you were. Before I do get into the episode, I've got a lot of people emailing me. A lot of people emailing me saying, hey, man, you look great. I know you got diabetes. How do I change my diet? How do I eat clean and all this? And I really appreciate all the people that are concerned with their health, you know? Why even be here if you're just going to take yourself out with shitty food and no exercise and everything, you know? You gotta keep yourself together. And I found a product that I've been using, a company that I love. And it's really, really been good for me as far as eating healthy and keeping things clean. It's Onnit. Onnit.com/Dean will be your code. Punch in onnit.com/Dean and get some of the stuff I'm using. I'm using their protein powder, which is incredible. They've got a grass-fed protein powder. I drink it twice a day. They've got a thing for old-timers like me, joint oil. And you could be laughing right now, but wait till you get around your late 40s, early 50s, and you're somebody that rode motorcycles all your life, and all of a sudden you go, man, my hands hurt. I feel like Clay from Sons of Anarchy. My hands, Gemma. My hands. I don't think I can ride my hands. I used to watch that and go, oh, what an old timer. Now I'm up here like, my hands. Anyway, they got this joint oil. I also use this EGN, Earth-Grown Nutrients, which is your daily greens. A lot of people hate vegetables like myself. I blend them all up, kale and all that shit. I don't like spinach or broccoli. Ugh, I'm a green bean man. I'm a one vegetable man, green beans. And so I use this Onnit Earth-Grown Nutrients daily greens. It's tasty. I also, you know, got a lot of mood problems. Everybody knows that. I'm up and down. I seem like I'm in a good mood all the time, but that's because I'm pushing it down. I'm pushing down the nuttiness. So I'm using their new mood daily stress formula, and I take that every day. And I also, I'll tell you the most home run product I use from Onnit, and it's helped my podcasting and my comedy and just conversations. I'm using Alpha Brain, and I take a couple of these today a day, and I tell you, I'm so focused when I'm doing an interview that I notice it myself. I'm like, man, I'm killing it on this interview. I'm fucking spot on. Alpha Brain. I can't tell you guys enough, man. Use this Alpha Brain. It's not like one of those dumb speedy things. It's caffeine-free, gluten-free, and you're not all tweaking. You just all of a sudden seem like, you know, like you remember when you were like in the seventh grade or something, you could just have a conversation and not be distracted. That's what it is. It's like seventh grader pills. Takes you back to like, oh yeah, I don't have a bunch of shit on my mind so I can listen to your conversation. Anyway, onnit.com/Dean, my new sponsor. And I tell you, man, these sponsors really help the podcast, but also I don't have any bullshit items. These are things I use and love, and you should try them out because, like I said, I wouldn't have something on here that I didn't use. Onnit is very, very kick-ass, their products. Onnit.com/Dean, and you'll get 10% off all products. So check it out. Start it up right now. That's about it. I love you guys, and I know you're going to love this episode. Make sure that you subscribe and leave reviews on iTunes, and check out the YouTube channel. I've been putting up all the episodes of Let There Be Talk on YouTube, and I'm digging it. You can find my YouTube channel by going to my Twitter feed and just hitting the bio. There it is, the link. Let's get into it right now. Thank you, guys. I hope to see you this week in Buffalo and then next week in New York City at The Stand. Looking forward to hitting some East Coast and getting out of the Thin Wall Cracker Box Hotel here, known as my new apartment. Love you guys. Candles lit. Colin Hanks. Yeah, here we are. Another episode of Let There Be Talk. Fantastic guest today. Introduce yourself.
My name is Steven. I know my name is Steven. No, Colin Hanks.
Colin Hanks!
What's up, man?
Fucking A, dude. Great to have you on.
Pleasure to be here. I'm glad we were finally able to connect.
Yeah, man. It's so funny because I've been trying to get you on for a while. What are you working on? Because you're working over on the Warner lot?
I'm on a TV show that shoots over at Fox called Life in Pieces that is on made at Fox, but is on CBS.
You know what's funny is, like, I went to the Tower Records movie.
Yeah.
And then I saw the Eagles of Death Metal movie, and we'll get into both of those. But I didn't even know that you were an actor ever. And
oh, rad.
I mean, because I don't watch TV.
Yeah, yeah.
But you've done...
I don't see a TV.
Yeah, there's no TV here. I don't watch TV. I do My life growing up, I watched TV like crazy. So, of course, I fucking watched your dad a million times. Bosom Buddies was my show.
There you go.
I fucking love that show.
For the 2 years that that show was on?
It was great, though. You know what's funny?
It was a good show, yeah.
I think they tried to remake that about 5 years ago. Somebody told me they went out for a pilot for
it. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I guess it didn't get picked up, but they were trying to make that again.
I'm sure they've tried to remake that like every 7 years.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. Man, it's so funny to think about Bosom Buddies to where your dad went after that. You're just like,
yeah,
what?
That's a journey. That's a journey for sure.
Especially back then when you think about TV, you were marked as like, you're just a TV guy. You weren't. Once you did TV, it was looked down upon back then. Now TV is great.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I remember one of the first jobs I ever got was on television. This was a show called Roswell. And I had gotten a movie, this movie called Orange County, and I there was filming at the same time, and so I went to the showrunner of the TV show, and I'm like, I have to ask, like, is there a way that I could do both? And he ended up, you know, being very gracious, and he said, we're going to write you off the show because obviously you're going on to movies now. And like the vibe, even then, this was, I don't know, like 99 or 2000, even the vibe then was like, oh, you're never going to have to do TV again. Like, yeah. Someone even said like, oh, congratulations, you'll never have to do television again.
Yeah.
And I remember even thinking then like, wow, that's odd.
Yeah.
But okay. And then, you know, within 10 years, like it just totally changed.
Well, everyone wants to be on TV now and compared to movies because it's just like, oh, I just drive down the street, I work, and then I come home, you know? In a good scenario,
yeah.
A lot of stuff shot like, you know, I mean, I've done some movies in Shreveport and you're out there just going like, get me out of here.
Shreveport. Right.
Everybody has in
I've
the business.
I've served some time in Shreveport. Yeah. I mean, there is something to be said. I mean, especially now that I'm older, it's a lot nicer to be able to be home. You know, I'm in LA now. I've been in LA for like 2.5-3 years without having to really leave town to go work for months at a time. And that's nice. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I like the circus. You know, I joined it for a reason. I don't mind going out and, you know, I've shot all over the world and it's a lot of fun. But it is kind of nice to be able to have just a little bit of job security for a few months out of the year.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's helpful.
And more people, I think, watch TV than they go to the movies now. You know, like I've done a bunch of movies.
Yeah.
Not that I've had big parts, but I don't think anybody saw them. You know?
Yeah. Well, there's definitely that, and you know, they movies have tended to sort of squeeze a lot of people out, and they've just sort of. You know, I have this joke that it's always like the same six people making all of the movies.
Yeah.
they don't want to share.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or they don't want to bring in too many new
people. It's like Clooney.
Yeah.
What's his name?
Well, I'm not really going up for his parts, but yes.
No, but I'm just saying, whenever I go to the movies, it's going to be Clooney. It's the Iron Man guy. What's his name?
Robert Downey Jr. Tends to be the same people.
Jennifer Lawrence.
Yeah, but with TV, like they've really, you know, they're much more willing to tell riskier stories. I think they're quite simply just telling more stories.
Yeah, and edgier now, which is great.
Yeah, for sure.
Like once you got into Sopranos, you know, that really, I think, kicked off of like, you know, back in the day of like, whoa, man, this is some edgy storytelling.
Oh, for sure. And it was always, you know, the joke I always have about Sopranos is like, I loved Sopranos and I'd watch it and I'd say, I wish I could be on the show. I mean, there's no way in hell that could happen because it's just not.
Yeah.
People don't think like, oh, well, let's get like some New Jersey mob types and, yo, let's get Colin Hanks. Like, that's not really something that could happen. But then a few years after, well, actually, no, it was right at the tail end of Sopranos was when Mad Men came out. And I remember the first time I watched Mad Men, I'm like, this is a show that I could actually go on. Like this isn't a stretch. It's all young, you know, young looking guys who look like kids in suits pretending to be adults. I could do that.
Yeah, and you so got the look.
So then I spent a year and a half trying to get on the show, and then eventually I did.
Oh man, it was the opposite for me. I tried to get on Sons of Anarchy for 6 seasons, never got on. Meanwhile, some guy walking down the street that fucking plays like bass in a band gets on. You're yeah, like, what the
right.
fuck,
that
man?
That sounds about right.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear you, man. It's, you know, TV is definitely so good now. There's just so much, too. There's too much now, though, man. Like, people are, you watching Ozark? I'm like, not yet. And they go, oh, well, you got to watch, you know, this and that. And I'm just like, I can't keep up.
It's hard. It's got to, there's, you know, you really got to, they got to get you at the right moment, you know?
Yeah.
And then they got to deliver. And in some ways, it's yeah, I mean, I'm with you. It's overload. There are too many shows. But the way that I sort of look at it is now, since you can pretty much get any show whenever you want.
Binge watch.
Which is great. I actually really enjoy that. It puts more the pressure on the show, like, get out of that gate really strong and, like make me want to watch this. Because I've got tons of other stuff that I could be doing. And, you know, there are shows that are able to really do that and sort of rise above. Like, have you seen Mindhunter?
No.
Dude, Mindhunter is fucking awesome.
What's that one about?
So it is produced by David Fincher, who directed a whole bunch. So that
love him.
Automatically sort of like puts it in
100%. I can't even believe I haven't heard. Oh, is it like the Twilight Zones?
Well, it's not that. That's Black Mirror. You're thinking Black Mirror.
Oh yeah. Okay.
No, Mindhunter is basically a show. It's on Netflix. Anyone can sort of check it out. But it's about these guys. It's really sort of loosely based on you know, actual, you know, sort of people, but it's about these two guys who work at the FBI that sort of come up with a study about serial killers. And
I read about it in Rolling Stone.
And it's incredible because it's not a violent show. There's not really any violence. There's no gore. It's not really what you think it is. It's just people in rooms talking, you know, about, you know, what makes people think that shit's okay.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, just like tons of stuff. And some of the conversations are a little uncomfortable. Some of the conversations are really dark. But the fact that they make it so gripping and so interesting, like that kind of shit, I go crazy for. It's like, oh, two people in a room talking and having an interesting conversation.
Oh, I'm into that.
As long as that is engaging, I'll give it a shot. And that one was one where I was just like, oh, I'm all in. And after every episode, I looked at my wife and she's like, I can't believe we're so into this show.
Oh yeah.
I can't believe we enjoy the show as much as we do, considering how dark it is. But
well,
like,
the darker the better, I think. Like Breaking Bad was humongous, you know.
Oh yeah.
But then I jumped on to Snowfall and they lost me after 5 episodes.
I don't know that
I think
one.
That's how quick you can get out. That was the one about the 80s crack.
Cocaine. Yeah. I remember the billboards.
Yeah, it started kind of good. I was like, this is good. And then, you know, all of a sudden they take a couple hokey turns. I'm like, I've got a life. I'm out.
It's hard, yeah. But, you know, like I think that's a good thing. Do you know what I mean? I think that sort of like grading curve, I think is actually good, because, you know, there's only so much time in the day.
It's true.
And I want to be able to watch stuff that is engaging in whatever ways it's trying to be engaging. If it's supposed to be funny, if it's supposed to be dramatic, if it's supposed to be mysterious or dark or any of these things, like, just as long as it's good.
Yep.
That's really the most important thing. And so, you know, there are too many shows, like, no doubt about that. But when you find those good ones, that it almost makes it worthwhile.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of people, I mean, it's almost like records now. There's so many records
out.
Absolutely. And everybody has different taste. I mean, to me, it's like, what has it got? Drugs and murder? Narcos? I'm in. Breaking Bad? I'm in. You know, bikers? Meth? Fuck yeah, I'm in.
Because
that shit was, you know, I'm 51. I grew up with TV. They never touched any of that shit. You know, Scarface is the only movie of all time that really covered like cocaine or something. So now it's like, well, these are the topics I'm into.
Well, yeah. I mean, there was a period where there were only 4 channels. Like, that was it.
That's, you know, so nuts.
There's 4 channels and then movies. Like, that was your only options. And so now it's sort of, changed and it's broadened. And I think in a lot of ways, one of the things that are really cool is when you can be watching a show, you know, about a motorcycle gang, you know, slinging meth, and you're like, well, I don't really think I would be into that kind of thing, but like, they tell an engaging story and they show characters that have conflict or are funny, that are likable. You know, it's the same thing with, you know, Sopranos. Everyone's like, yeah, wow, I can't believe I'm rooting for this guy that's, you know, fucking horrible.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, or Breaking Bad, or, you know, any of these kinds of things. And that kind of, to be able to get those kinds of stories out there, I think is interesting, because, you know, hopefully it leads to, you know, conversations, and maybe people be a little less judgmental about some things, or more so, do you know what I mean? It sort of shows that ambiguity, which I think is really important for storytelling.
What's the dude's name that did, I'm drawing.
Dude, we just call him Dude.
Yeah, Dude. I'm drawing a blank on his name now, but he did, the show, Crash. He did the movie Crash. He and also Million Dollar Baby. He wrote that stuff.
Paul Haggis.
Paul Haggis. I went to a Paul Haggis thing once where he was giving a speech on writing. And after I talked to him and I was telling him about this idea I had about a biker gang before Sopranos. Mm-hmm. And I mean, before Sons of Anarchy. And I remember a key thing he said to me. And the reason I'm bringing it up is because what you just said, like, oh, I didn't think I'd be into this. But I was telling the story, and he goes, the problem with your story is I don't like your character, your lead character. Mm-hmm. Tony Soprano, we start liking for like a whole season before he even murders.
Yeah.
And then by then you're fucked, because you're going like, oh.
You're actually invested in him.
Yeah, you're like, well, he's kind of a cool dude, though. I mean, he did have to kill that guy. Yeah. You know what I mean? And you start justifying murder and shit. Yeah. That's great writing and great storytelling.
And that kind of, you know, detail, you know, the amount of energy that is spent actually trying to put yourself in another person's shoes and understand what it is that they're going through, and sort of taking in information, you know, through their lens and all that sort of stuff. That kind of stuff is really fascinating and exciting to me. That's why I became an actor. That's why I you know, got into, you know, watching movies and you know, all different kinds of stories, like just stories, like in general.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's another reason why I got into documentaries, because it was another way to get a better understanding of what people's experiences are. And those are always fascinating because they're real, you know,
right?
They're actually real people. And you sort of understand, or you start to get a better sense of like, oh, wow, okay, so this is what this person was thinking at that time. And it sort of gives you a little bit of insight, and you actually learn something about people. You know, that to me, I think, is like the most important thing about storytelling is, you know, all right, I want to give people a sense of what this character is going through or what this person went through. And, you know, when you're able to do that in, you know, an effective way, that is sort of like the whole fucking point.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I absolutely love both your documentaries, and I watched a smoking one last night that just blew me out of the water. It was Jim and Andy.
Oh, right? Yeah.
And I don't know if you watched
it. I saw it, yeah.
Yeah, did you enjoy
that?
That's a
trip. It was a fun watch.
It was a fun watch.
Yeah, I mean,
it would have been horrible to be there.
Crazy fucking watch, yeah. I mean, you see any of the shots of Paul Giamatti, and he's just like, oh, I can't believe I got to fucking go through this.
I know, right? Yeah, right? Paul Giamatti, what a god that guy is.
It was actually funny, because there's a makeup artist that I've worked with, who I just love, and I hadn't spoken to him in a while, and he's in the movie for like a brief moment.
Right.
When Carrie comes in and he's like full Clifton in the makeup trailer, and it's just a shot of my friend Bill, and he's just got this look like,
yeah.
The camera, like, oh, fuck.
Some of that shit was like fascinating.
This. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's weird. There are components of that I think are interesting and are sort of worth examination. And then there's another part of me as an actor that goes like, what a fucking dick move.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Like, that's incredibly egotistical and stupid. But then at the same time, it's like, well, if that's what he felt like he needed to do to do that,
yeah,
to for his art, all right, sure. You
it's
know.
Like Val Kilmer doing Jim. You got to call him Jim the whole time.
Yeah,
you know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah. And you know, and I've been in scenarios sort of similar to that. Obviously, not that extreme.
Yeah.
But you know, like I don't know. The thing that I found really weird about that is he never seemed to turn it off.
No.
Which I think is like really important. You know, I mean, I did this movie a few years ago called Elvis and Nixon, and Michael Shannon was playing Elvis, and you know, he was really into it. I mean, he was definitely in character, you know, from the first scene until the last scene, but like in the makeup trailer, he'd be like, "Hey, Colin."
Yeah.
He'd say hello, and then at the end of the day, he'd say, "Bye, Colin." Like, there was at least this understanding of like, look, that's work.
Yeah.
And I'm more than happy to play along with that. Do you know what I mean? And that, like, that was a good example of someone like, you know, being super serious and dedicated, but you know, he wasn't a dick about it, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you know, again, I think the thing that was interesting about the Jim and Andy doc is that I think at the end of it, he's kind of like, yeah, I'm not sure if that was really worth it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it obviously really, you know, like messed with his head, you know? And yeah. I think it would, and I think maybe that's a good example of maybe why not to do something like that.
Well, I think he was slowly going crazy himself, as he starts to say, because he's the biggest star in the world all
yeah,
of a sudden.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And he's trying to get away from that, and the same thing that Andy was trying to get away from the foreign guy, Lotka.
Yeah,
you know, that whole thing, it's almost like dual parallel their lives, you know what I mean? It's like Farley and John Belushi.
Yeah,
you know, absolutely. Farley worshipped him, and all of a sudden you get caught up in this thing, you
yeah.
know.
Yeah,
it's pretty wild.
Not the first time actors have run away from things that are haunting them.
how do you? It's funny because your dad is a huge star, and you have been able not to become a dick, like a you know who my dad is yeah. or a drug.
Well, we don't know
loser.
Each other that well.
But I'm just saying, yeah. I've never read about you. You know what I mean? Is like you know Tom Hanks' son.
Yeah,
fucking. Busted with cocaine. Were you ever busted or anything?
No. Well, I mean, I had run-ins with the law, but they were pretty G-rated. There wasn't anything too bad. I think more than anything else, it's just not quite my thing. Do you know what I mean? I think more than anything, it's I think there's just look, life is difficult enough as is, you know?
Yep.
And I think given any sort of scenario, there's fun with problems, and then there's just problems. And I'd never wanted to get to the point where it's just problems.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Or
and
that.
And so it's, you know, it's, why make things more difficult than they need to be? That's really sort of the way that I've sort of looked at things. And that goes for, you know, going to work and you know, trying to start a career. Like, that was hard enough as is, you know. I'm really fortunate in that I was able to sort of find something that I was really, really passionate about and that I genuinely loved. And it wasn't, and I was given the space to fall in love with it on my own. It wasn't something that was forced on me. It wasn't anything that was overtly expected of me.
Yeah, you went to college, right? Like
for a little while.
Right, but you were like, fuck it, I'm going to try something else.
Well, I mean, it was a little bit strange because I grew up in Northern California. And
Sacramento?
So, Sacramento, yeah.
Did you see Lady Bird?
I did see Lady Bird. Lady Bird was shot on the street I grew up on.
That is crazy.
Yeah, it's fucking weird, man. It was really strange seeing.
Did your dad live up there, or they're divorced?
Well, no, my parents divorced when I was pretty young, but my parents had met at Sac State.
Oh, wow.
And so, I had family that lived there. And so when my parents split up, my mom, my sister and I, we moved back up to Sacramento, and I would come down to LA a lot. I mean, I was spent a lot of my childhood on a plane traveling one place or another, but Sacramento was really where I was raised. And so
you ever go to the press club or any of that?
Of course. Yeah.
Fuck yeah.
The press club, the cattle club.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Boardwalk.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
was a little, yeah. and then what's the other one? Continental.
The Continental was there. I mean, it's, oh man, it's changed so much.
Did you watch bands like, how old are you?
I am 40. I just turned 40.
What about bands like, let's see here, like, Cake was big there, but FMK.
FMK. I never saw them. I mean, I saw like flyers for them.
Yeah.
It's funny. I mean, I was pretty young I was a big music kid growing up.
Mother Hips guy?
Yeah, I definitely checked them out. But like for me, there was a period there that was like really just more just like Sacramento bands that never like really went anywhere else.
Sweetvine? You get into them?
No, there was a band called Funky Blue Velvet that I really liked. There was another band called Little Guilt Shrine, pretty much all three word bands that then just like went down to acronyms.
Right.
But Far was big when I was growing up. Deftones were obviously
Deftones,
really big.
Deftones, of course.
Cake was obviously another big one. And so there's really mostly just like a bunch of bands that never really made it out of Sacramento. Like
yeah.
Far, Deftones, and then there was this another band, Simon Says. Those were sort of like the three that kind of like made it out of that sort of scene. Cake was kind of like a special, Cake was almost like an anomaly almost.
Yeah, that was just crazy.
No one sounded like them and they were just so different.
They're a lot like Primus to where you're like, what style are they?
You know what I mean? Exactly. And like, I was a big Primus fan growing up. I mean, I was obsessed with it. In fact, you just had Lur on
the
show.
Yeah,
yeah. I was listening to that.
That band right now is, I can't tell you how much I think they need to get glory, because when you go see this band and it's 30 years now or something, yeah, and it's sold out, you know, like they're doing two nights at the Wiltern and they got a new record out and you're seeing this band and they don't have your cliche hit, you know, of course mm-hmm. they got like, you know, their songs, but they're not like, when they're writing, they're like, this is going to be a hit, you know?
No, not
first
at all.
Chorus, verse, bridge, all
no,
that.
No, not at all.
But they fucking are unbelievable, man.
I was really drawn to them because they were so different.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that was really sort of like the big thing for me growing up. I mean, Sacramento is an amazing place. I love it to death. And actually, Lady Bird is kind of like this, where, you know, you're growing up in a place and you're just like, God, I just want to get the fuck out of here. And that's an important building block, I think, for anybody. And then you get out and then you sort of realize like how special it was. And Sacramento at that time, you know, I didn't think it was all that special. I didn't think it was all that unique, but because of that, it led me to places. It led me to places like Tower Records, and that's where I was able to get into, you know, Primus and, you know, Mr. Bungle and just like all of these
Mr. Bungle,
just
man.
Very different kinds of things. And then I was very fortunate in that I sort of came up, like to use the high school phrase, but I came up, you know, during the era of grunge and music, and got to see this you know, music change sort of before. Like when I was younger, it was all hair metal bands and all that sort of stuff. And I watched that shit on MTV and I loved Def Leppard Hysteria, you know, and listened to that in fourth grade on the school bus and all that sort of stuff. But then to see music change, it was like, oh, well, this is my kind of stuff.
That's your fucking, your era, your
that
Grateful
was,
Dead,
my,
your hippie
exactly.
era, but you know, whatever you want to call
exactly.
it.
Exactly. And like Primus was a big example of like, oh, well, you know, this is kind of cool for, you know, a majority of people, but they're not really all that into it, but I'm going to go all in on this and become obsessed.
and
learn everything.
So.
Yeah. And learn everything I can about it, and learn what their influences are and who inspired them to do, you know, what they're doing, and, you know, pay more attention to the bass player and things like that. And as a result of that, I was able to really sort of find my identity and who I was. And, you know, that sort of component, like, there are components of punk and stuff that I really love and I really resonate with, and you know, questioning authority and things like that. But I was also kind of like, yeah, but there's no need to make a scene if there's no need for it. You know,
right.
I don't need to rebel just to rebel.
Fake anger.
I'm not into that. I would spend much more time trying to find like what's unique, what's different, and what's really interesting. Because what's the thing that needs to exist purely to exist?
Yeah.
And that was like, that was Primus for me. That was, you know, discovering the Meters and
Ecstasy.
Yeah.
Funky
and
Meters.
Yeah, it's like all different kinds of stuff.
Tom Waits, everything, the branches that come off that are just insane.
And so that really sort of led me to sort of go like, oh, I'm going to sort of like do my own thing a little bit and sort of find my own identity. But like really at the end of the day, I was also sort of like, there's no need to rock a boat. Like things are fine. Like, second. Yeah. That was fine.
Yeah. It's true.
There's stuff to rebel against, sure, and I most definitely did. I'm not saying, you know, I was home by 8 every night, but like, you know, for me, it's just much more about, you know, finding interesting things and keeping myself engaged and trying to turn other people onto stuff. And that's more of an inclusive thing as opposed to a standoffish, crazy thing. And I, you know, look, I saw a bunch of kids that I grew up with, that, you know, sort of got mixed up and sort of turned around and sort of saw the direction that they were going. And I didn't really have time for that. Didn't really sort of want that. And
well, that 99's a lot of meth, man. And that kind of scene from Bakersfield to Sacramento, you got all these weird little shit cities, you know, Modesto, Visalia, you know, Manteca. You know what I mean? And you know, just
Manteca. Yeah, Manteca. It's like Manteca, the water slides and meth.
That fucking kind of like water slide. I used to race BMX there, man.
Oh, really?
That water slide was the first water slide back in the day.
Oh, absolutely.
It was like one of the most radical places, you know, and they had a BMX track there, and it was just like, but those little cities are pockets of serious trouble, you know?
Yeah, and I don't know, so I don't call it a spidey sense or whatever, but I would sort of like flirt around that, but never really flew too close to that because it was just sort of saw where that was sort of headed and just said, I would much rather go over here.
I would go to the Cal Expo and see some of the greatest concerts ever there.
Yeah.
I saw Judas Priest there on the Defenders of the Faith tour.
Amazing.
I saw Aerosmith when Joe Perry wasn't in the band there. Fucking lightning strikes.
I saw him when he was in the band there.
Yeah, and then I did too. Remember that? Someone threw a rock at Steven Tyler. Were you at that gig?
I was not at that one.
Whoa,
no.
Whoa, man.
No, I don't
at
remember
at Cal
that
Expo. And then when I saw, I remember I saw America there. I went through the desert on a horse.
Wow.
Dude. But that, you know, Sacramento's a big music town. It doesn't get a lot of glory on it, but it would be a place that all the major bands would go to, even the Arco Arena. I used to go there to see like the big bands like AC/DC because the Arco Arena was small.
I remember when AC/DC came through on the Razor's Edge tour.
LA Guns on it.
Right. Yeah. I remember seeing Metallica played there on the Black Album tour. I was at that show. And then I remember Cal Expo was big. I saw a bunch of bands there. I saw The Cure play there. I saw Aerosmith play there. The one of the shows that I regret not going to, and I will say that I was so young that I was not allowed to go to, was Jane's on the
first record?
No, the second record.
Oh, yeah,
On Ritual, they played. But I lived close enough that I could hear echoes.
Really?
From Cal Expo. And I would just I was like in my room, like with the window open, just so like trying to hear oh, I heard an echo. That's Jane's Addiction playing right now. Oh my God. I wonder if they're playing 3 Days.
Yeah.
Oh God. Oh,
3 Days, the best song ever. Yeah. Right?
Oh, the song that went
that
on.
That venue
so
was weird. It was just like a parking lot. It was just like you're standing on blacktop.
That one was a weird venue. And I saw Pearl Jam play on their aborted anti-Ticketmaster tour.
Yeah.
And it was the last full show that they did on that tour, because then the next show they did in San Francisco, Eddie Vedder got sick and then they canceled the rest of the tour. So I still have the shirt that has all of the dates, but they only played 3 of them.
Wow. You know what's weird is they tore those weird movie theaters down just this year. Those weird
pods. Century Theaters?
Yeah. And they put a new one up.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was just there this weekend doing comedy at the Punchline, me and Joey Diaz.
Yeah.
And those weird space pods there. They were like all Arclight domes.
Yeah, they had like 4 of them or like 3 of them, and then they expanded them at some point right before I left. They're all gone now?
Yeah, they're gone. They made it all new now. Yeah,
that's a bummer.
Fucking, and that whole mall's new now, which is
the Arden Fair Mall.
Not there, where the parking lot of that place, they put like a part 2 of the Arden Fair Mall.
Oh geez, yeah, more of a mall. Let's put another mall in.
How do you now? I saw the Tower Records film, and I have all these dreams of making documentaries myself because they're things that really sit with me, and I'm like, how is there not a documentary on this? And there's so many great documentaries now. But when you decide to do the Tower Records, I watched the film, of course, but I had so many questions for you. Was You know, I grew up in San Francisco. The one on Bay Street was my Tower Records.
There you go.
I'd go there every fucking Tuesday.
Yep.
The new releases would be out, and then I'd be hanging in the magazines forever.
Yeah.
How do you, you know, come up with like, all right, I want to do this film, which, by the way, is it on Netflix still?
It's not on Netflix, but it is on...
iTunes?
It's on iTunes, and then... Showtime had it for a while, so it's all like if you get Showtime,
right.
It's on demand there too. It's now kind of like I don't know exactly how, where things end up now, but Netflix. I don't think it's going to be on Netflix for a while. But it's
why
on
is that?
It's this weird thing of it's kind of like a shell game where like someone buys it from you and then they sell it to someone else and then they sell it to someone else and then it sort of goes down the line and then they have all of these like windows of how long this person has it, how long that person has it until eventually it's
I mean that's got to be on there. Netflix. It's such a
it will be
it's
eventually.
A classic
it will be eventually,
especially with vinyl back now. People don't understand the magnitude of what Tower Records was to me or you or anybody that would just, you would just go there, you know, drop me off here.
Yeah.
I'm good for the day.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's really where it started for me. I mean, it was just the place to go. I mean, that was my candy shop. That, I didn't have a sweet tooth, so I would just go and spend time in Tower or other record stores. The Beat was another one
in
Sacramento that I went to a lot. But really it was just a place for me to go and hang out. You know, I had a few friends, but they weren't necessarily huge music fans. You know, I played in a band in high school. And so, you know,
what'd you play?
I played bass.
Yeah.
I played bass. We were in a horrible band called Pontius Pilate. I didn't know who Pontius Pilate was until like 7 months into the band.
Who is Pontius Pilate?
He's the guy who ordered the crucifixion of Jesus Christ.
Oh my God. I don't read the Bible, so.
Neither did I. My Bible reading.
Well, that seems like a
strange
thing.
My Bible reading mom was the one who told me, and she's like, the band is called what? And I went, oh, is this bad? Oh, okay.
I was never into bass until Carlos from Interpol came around and was like, this is how you do it. You be the coolest guy in the band. I was like, oh, fuck.
There you go.
Because without him, I don't even listen to Interpol. Now, you know what I mean?
There you go. So like for me, like going to Tower, that was just sort of where I was able to learn about other bands and like be able to like find out, like I was saying earlier, like find out what their influences were. And then, you know, that was where I would go to find the Meters. Because back then, you know, I wasn't going to go to the library to go read about the Meters.
And there was no online.
And if there was no one to really tell me about it, I didn't have an older brother. I didn't really have, you know, too many older friends that were as obsessed with music as I was. That was the only place that I could sort of go. So I really fell in love with Tower when I was a kid. And when I was growing up, my godmother, I had found out she had worked at Tower in San Francisco sort of in the 70s, along with another good friend of my mom's. The two of them had worked at Tower. So I had heard stories about, you know, what a great place it was to work at and all that sort of stuff. But it wasn't until the stores were closing in 2006. And at that point, you know, I had moved down to L.A., gotten work as an actor, and so I would be able to go to New York and there would be a Tower Records. You know, I went and worked in London, there was a Tower Records there. So it was like this place that was always sort of a reminder of home.
Yeah.
And it was sort of friendly. And even when the stores got a little big and a little impersonal, it was still sort of like,
I
know I could go in there and still spend a few hours, you know, killing time. And
they had everything too early on, like where you couldn't get shit. You know, AC/DC being one of the biggest bands in my life ever. But that's where I found out about import records.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, imports, what's that? And they go, well, these records are from Australia.
Yeah.
And they've got different covers and different songs.
Yes.
And they're going like, what? What is
crazy.
That shit?
Yeah. And why are they so much more expensive?
Yeah. But then then they go, oh, and we have shirts here too that you can't find anywhere. Here's an Iron Maiden Peace of Mind shirt.
It just
like,
goes,
fuck.
All those rabbit holes go very, very deep. And I would just, that's what I put all my, that's how I spent my money. That's what I'd spent all my money, my time at. And then in 2006, I was living in New York I was kind, you know, I was still working. I've always been working in some capacity, but there would always be like these long stretches of like not really much going on.
What neighborhood were you living in?
I was in the West Village.
Oh yeah.
So I mean, I was doing pretty well.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was doing all right. But I had a lot of spare time on my hands, and all of the sort of the people that I knew in New York that sort of worked in sort of my business or industry were all sort of comedy people, and they were all partnered up with people and writing stuff or actually like working. And so I desperately wanted to come up with something to do to help fill up the time.
Right.
Now the tower was done.
Yeah.
And it was crazy. A good friend of mine's mother, who's kind of like family to me, she was in town. So I went out to dinner with her, and she had walked by the tower on the Upper West Side. We were just talking about what a bummer it was that the stores were closing, because it had the huge, you know, going out of business sign. And so we were talking about that, and, you know, sort of at the end of the conversation, sort of dies down, and she just goes, I just can't believe it all started in that little pharmacy. And I said, wait, what?
Yeah.
And she sort of told me about Russ Solomon, who I had heard about, from my godmother, who had worked at Tower. And I heard what a good guy he was, but I didn't really know anything about his story and, you know, him.
I didn't either. I couldn't believe
it. Yeah. And that was like, once she told me that, you know, he started selling used 78s out of his father's drugstore when he was a kid.
Tower Drugs.
Sort of turned out of the Tower Pharmacy, and that's how it sort of started. I mean, I said out loud, I'm like, well, that's a fucking documentary. Like,
yeah.
Wow. And so that really sort of piqued my interest in. So I started doing a lot of research because I could at that time, now with the internet.
Yeah.
And ironically, I did go to a library to learn even more.
library had shit on Tower Records?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Just to find like articles and just like just trying to find. I had so much spare time because I wasn't working.
Like a library in New York had Tower Records?
Yeah.
The Fishy Film or whatever?
Yeah, the Microfiche.
Wow, yeah. No shit.
Oh,
huh?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, I've since become like a huge supporter of libraries. My wife and I, we do a bunch of stuff for the library here in Los Angeles. Like, it's a massive resource. You'd be really shocked at how much shit you can get at a library. I really spent time really trying to understand the history a little bit more of, you know, the music retail and merchandising and things like that, and sort of learning about the scope. And of course, there were tons of things going on at that time about Tower closing, a bunch of things on NPR and stuff. So I was able to get a better sense of that history. And the more and more I listened to interviews with Russ, I go, this guy's pretty cool. This guy seems interesting. And you know, Sacramento being a pretty small town, I was able to get an intro through my friend's dentist.
Oh, wow. Wow. I love it.
Yeah, because a buddy of mine, Tim Comstock, who has worked on the movie at the sort of early stages, he had done a documentary about Ron Santo, baseball player, played for the Cubs. And so I, like, you know, asked him a bunch of questions about, you know, starting a doc. And then eventually I just said, like, I don't think anyone else is going to do this, so
yeah.
I'll do it. And it was the beginning of a very long process.
Yeah, it took
about 7 years.
Whoa!
Yeah,
because I want to dive into a documentary.
Yeah,
something I feel really, really passionate about. And I know what it is. There's two things I want to do, but I was wondering, like,
it
7 years.
Time. Yeah, it takes time, but also keep in mind that the economy had just gone in the shitter at the time. So people weren't really financing things, and they sure as hell weren't financing documentaries, because this was before Netflix had gone to the other model of the streaming.
Yeah, it was the fucking send them in your mailbox
and so
shit.
Documentaries were really movies that played like in two theaters in America, like
the good
New
ones
York
every
or LA,
time.
That was it.
Like Sunset 5.
And they would play for like a week.
That's
and that was sort of it. So, you know, there wasn't any money in documentaries. There's still not really any money in documentaries, but it was like we spent a lot of time going out, trying to get financing, trying to, you know, secure enough money to go forward. And so we would just sort of go bit by bit. And we
did you shoot like a sizzle reel or something to give somebody the idea?
We did. We when we went up to meet with Russ for the first time, and he sort of agreed to it. He's like, "You guys are crazy. You're never going to make any money, but let's do it." Which is a very Russ thing to. Russ response. On a, you know, just on a lark, I decided to go drive by the old Watt Avenue store, which wasn't really close to me, but I spent a lot of time there.
The original one by the pharmacy.
No, not the original one. So the original one by the pharmacy, which is known as 16th and Broadway, that
Tower
actually
still
that wasn't the original. So the original technically is the pharmacy, but right. the first proper like standalone was the one on Watt Avenue, which was
that the one with the movie theater?
No, that's not the one by the movie theater.
What is that one with the big tower ball?
That is the Tower Theater where the pharmacy was.
Okay.
It's now called the Tower Cafe.
Gotcha, yeah.
And then eventually, once Russ started opening up more stores, he opened up the 16th and Broadway across from the original pharmacy and the movie theater.
Gotcha.
So Watt Avenue was this, like, we say it in the movie, like, it's out in the middle of, it was out in the middle of nowhere, really, when they originally opened it up, some more towards Fair Oaks, like way, way, way up, sort of outskirts of, like, far.
Like Orangevale area or
not
something?
Not Orangevale, but, like, it might as well might as well be. And so I sort of drove out there as a lark just to see what was still there, because at that time, there were still, by that time it had been like a year and a half since they had closed, and they were still having a hard time finding people to go into the old tower stores because they had sort of gotten so big.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That it was hard for, you know, companies to come in and take over the space. So
like it would have to be like a grocery store or
something,
right?
And so I drove out there and the signs was still up. I mean, it still said, you know, "All things must pass. Thanks, Sacramento." Like it was still there. They still had all the racks. Like literally,
that's the one in the movie.
Yeah. And they literally like closed that door and then it just sat there for a year and a half. And so that really like put a fire under my ass. I'm like, I have to get something together to shoot some of this to put together for a sizzle reel. So we did that. And a lot of that footage that we shot ended up being in the film. And then we put a sizzle reel together, went around to a bunch of places, got laughed out of a lot of rooms. They just said, like, no one's going to give a shit about a company that went bankrupt, you know, a year and a half, 2 years ago, when Lehman Brothers and all of the car companies and all of Western civilization is going broke.
Yeah, good guys.
Yeah.
All that stuff.
The entire fucking economy. I mean, it just fucking died. And so there, you know, looking back on it now, I can say that there wasn't enough distance in the rearview mirror for people to really think about Tower and like care, you know,
right?
For those that didn't already,
it wasn't
care.
Like 25 years ago.
Yeah,
or something, right?
And so I spent the next few years like, you know, still thinking about it, still talking about it, and the more you pitch your idea, the more people you talk to, it's sort of, the idea gets a little bit better and a little tighter, and you sort of get a little bit more of a vision. And then luckily technology became a little bit cheaper, because then you could start filming things on like a Canon, you know, 5D and stuff like that. Which
was it something that you worked on actually every day, or would it be weeks off?
No, it would be like weeks and months off.
Right.
And then eventually Kickstarter came around, and that was a fucking lifesaver. That, I mean, that really saved the film.
What did it cost you to make?
All in, well, it was more than what we raised on Kickstarter, because we ended up having to go out and secure more funds even after the Kickstarter. So it cost a pretty penny. They're not cheap to
make. Like what? Like a million bucks?
No, same, I hold those cards close to the chest.
I got. I'm just curious, because it seems like, you know, a lot of the stuff is stock footage that he had. Did he have that stuff?
He had a lot of stock footage. We ended up having to pay for a lot of stock footage.
To him?
No, not to him, but to other people, news agencies, things like that. There was one guy who we ended up we paid him some money for the Elton footage because he found that footage in a dumpster.
Wow.
And it's just his now. Like,
that
he owns
Elton
it.
John footage when he's in shopping.
Yeah, somebody
just threw that away.
Someone threw it away and some dude found it in the dumpster and it's held onto it. And so, you know, we had to pay him. And then, you know, we ended up, you know, we knew going in that music was going to be really expensive, you know, but it was this challenge because, you know, at that point, you know, after the Kickstarter and stuff, documentaries started becoming a lot more popular and like, oh, I saw this documentary on, say, Netflix, started being more and more of a conversation. And it was hard because one of the things that I noticed is a lot of the documentaries that I liked, that I loved, that were about, you know, obscure bands or whatever, they were really low quality. And
right.
And I don't mind that. I like the, you know, the DIY components of anything, really.
The audio always pisses me off.
Audio can be bad, you know, but, you know, and but when you're doing it, you're like, okay, well, but I want to do more and I want to do it better and I want it to be the official one. Like, I don't want there to be another documentary about Tower Records after us.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't want to be the deep impact to somebody else's Armageddon. Fuck that. Like, I want it to be the real one. And I had spent so much time and energy talking with Russ and all of the other people saying, like, look, I really passionately want to do this. No one else really wants to fund it, but I want to make it. And so I really spent a lot of time and energy and, you know, my own money as well as other people's, you know, doing it right. Cause there's no point in doing it if you're not going to sort of do it right. And
absolutely.
And I had spent so many hours watching other great documentaries, but because the sound is shitty or because, you know, it's shot on video or any number of things, or because they can't afford to pay for the songs or any of the licenses.
Oh, the songs go away. That's the worst.
Like, it hurts the film.
Yep.
And so I really spent a lot of time and energy. Like, look, if we're going to do this, let's really do it right. And unfortunately it took a long time, you know, but I also argue that made the movie better
because
the more and more
gave
people
more
that got involved, I was able to really sort of finesse it and fine tune it. And I ended up learning more on that Tower Doc than anything else, because really just like the amount of knowledge I learned from Russ, I realized like, you don't have to have a big grand master plan. You just have to have a gut feeling and go and figure it out as you go and hire smart people that know what they're doing and don't get in the way and don't micromanage and all of these things that Russ really sort of like pioneered and really sort of, you know, talks about a lot, you know, both in the movie and just in life. Those were all things that helped me get the movie made and helped me do everything I've done since, you know, and it ended up being a big life-changing experience for me.
It's fucking incredible. I love the film. I went to the premiere and then the party. Mm-hmm. They actually painted Tower Records.
We did that.
Yeah, you guys did that?
We did that, yeah.
Now, Gibson had bought the building, Gibson Guitars, right?
Yeah, so the thing with that was, this was actually really cool. Gibson, so we had spent months and months and months and months and months trying to get Elton John.
Right.
And we were dealing with his publicist, who's, I'll just say, an incredibly professional lady.
Yeah.
She's a fucking ball buster, but she's protects her clients like no one's business. And she ended up being a huge, huge supporter of us and of the film. And we had done the interview with Elton, and then it happens that her company also represented Gibson.
Right.
And Gibson had taken over the lease, although it hadn't been announced yet. And she said, you should really talk with these guys that are making this Tower Records documentary. So I went into Gibson and met like the brass at Gibson, and was sort of like, they basically were like, tell us about like the history of this building, because we know that it's iconic. We love it. That's why we have it now.
Right.
But like, fill us in. And maybe you want to, you know, incorporate this part into the documentary. And unfortunately, we had already like locked picture. So I said, look, I can't include this in the doc, but I'll tell you anything you want to know. And that sort of started this great relationship with Tower and Gibson and like that. And so they had offered to throw us a party at South By, where we had a premiere. So we had a big party at the Gibson showroom out in Austin. And then when the film was purchased for distribution, they were like, do you want to throw the party here? And I'm like, oh, thank God you asked, because yeah. I've been wanting to ask that for like months. And so, I mean, that was a big sort of DIY thing. I mean, the people at Gibson were awesome, and they let us, they gave us the space, and they let us paint it up. And
who painted it? Some buddies or someone?
My partner, Sean, my producing partner, he basically just hired some set decorators that we know. And just
it's still
threw,
like that.
Threw him some money. Well, that's on Gibson. Gibson was super cool because the city of West Hollywood told us to we had to take it down.
Yeah.
And we were just, we like got two or three emails, and we're like, we finally responded like, look, like we don't have the money to like paint the entire building again. So like, you know, unless you want us to just like go with red and just paint over the tower, like that's what it's going to be. It's going to be really ugly.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, do that. And then we sort of said, okay. And then we never did. And then we kept getting more emails. We just never responded.
Yeah.
And then they just stopped sending emails. Wow. And Gibson has been super fucking cool because not only have they kept that up, and they've since done, like Elton John performed there.
Yeah, yeah, they did the GNR thing.
The GNR museum thing. I mean, they've had a lot of stuff there. Not only have they always kept the tower signage up, which I love, and that's sort of a big draw for it.
Oh, God, yeah.
But they've been super awesome. They've kept the All Things Must Pass poster up.
And unbelievable.
I cannot thank Gibson enough. If anyone who works for Gibson is listening, I cannot thank them enough because that's the only billboard I've ever had for a movie that I've directed.
Wow.
Like, billboards cost so much fucking money. It's stupid. Yeah. It's so fucking stupid. And they have always kept, not only have they kept the poster up, they've replaced it like three times.
Really?
And even when Guns N' Roses came in, Guns N' Roses are like, all right, so we'll put just GNR stuff everywhere. And Gibson's like, no, that's going to stay.
Wow.
Like that All Things Must Pass poster is going to stay.
Unbelievable.
And it was funny because I actually, since the movie came out, I met both Duff and Slash, and they're like, oh, well, yeah, man, that should totally stay up there. It's part of Tower.
Yeah.
It's part of Tower now. I'm like, oh, that's
I wonder
awesome.
What Gibson's going to do, because they were going to move in there as a a guitar high-end,
showroom.
A showroom.
I think they're still trying to like figure out exactly how they want to do that and what they want to do.
Yeah, because Gibson's hurting right now, big time.
Yeah, and they really want to do it right. And that was the thing that I loved, because there was a whole thing that we sort of, we shot a bunch of stuff for the film that we ended up not using. But there was a whole movement to, by some really cool people to try and like landmark it and
right.
make it like
I remember that.
A thing. And unfortunately, that didn't really work out because it didn't fit the criteria, which is bullshit. But at the same time, I understand because
right.
it's not a fancy architectural. Like, technically, there's nothing special about the building
itself.
Yeah, it's
itself. Not a case study house or a Frank Lloyd Wright or something.
I mean, it literally
but
is.
But it is a Hollywood landmark.
But it has you know, it has the heart there. Do you know what I mean? And Gibson, that's why they got it. And they really want to help celebrate that. And I think that what I really love about them is they're not like rushing it. They really are genuinely trying to find like what is the thing that makes the most sense for this.
Well, we're losing every iconic building on that street.
Yeah.
And you know, fucking, you know, these hotels are going up.
Yeah.
And pretty soon everything's going to be gone, and it'll just be hotels with nothing to do.
Yeah,
people exactly. are going to be like, well, what was the big deal of staying on the Sunset Strip? They used to have the Viper Room there. Yeah, they used to have the Tower Records. A House of Blues was there. Yeah. The only thing right, you know, I can't believe how great it is that the Roxy, and even if you don't go or anything, the Rainbow, the Viper
there.
Room,
yeah.
and the Comedy Store are all still there. Still and there. The Whiskey, man,
yeah,
that's not there. Going anywhere.
That's incredible. And that, so like for the premiere, like that was a big thing that we pretty much sort of like put together. We raised more funds, and we sort of like did that. It was basically like four people that helped sort of put that together, along with the distributors. They chipped in and really helped put that party on. But what I wanted that to feel like the record releases that I remember like seeing footage of.
Oh, yeah. Waiting in line for the double Guns N' Roses
illusion. That's why I got Eagles to come out and play, because, you know, their Zipper Down record had just come out, and I was like, man, wouldn't it be cool if like we could have the premiere party and then you guys could play, and it's kind of like the spiritual like continuation of like Tower doing an in-store where you shut down Sunset.
Yeah.
And you sort of do that. And, you know, Josh and Jesse and them were like, fuck yeah, let's do it. I didn't know you were there that night.
I was there. Yeah.
Oh, that's rad.
Yeah. With Steve Agee.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Agee. Yeah.
And
of course.
Josh got food poisoning, so he didn't play.
So fucking stressful.
Oh my God.
That was so stressful. I remember seeing Brian, their manager. He was like off to the side because I was like talking to so many people. And then I feel my phone vibrate and it was Brody saying like, my baby's not doing well right now. He's sick. He's got food poisoning. And I look over at Brian.
Yeah.
And he's just got this look on his face. I'm like, oh fuck. And that ended up being Julian Dorio's
first gig.
I went up and met with him and he's like, got its fucking headphones in, like trying to like, he's air drumming, trying to like find out like, fuck, what do I play? Because I think he'd only rehearsed like 2 times with the band at that point.
Oh yeah. Man.
That was crazy. That was a fun night, dude.
That was a great night.
But it makes me never want to get into concert promotion.
Oh, fuck all that.
I never want to throw a concert again in my life.
Yeah. I only had one question after the documentary. I was dying to ask you this for a couple years now. I love the documentary. But really what I wanted was, at the end, you have these employees, and people, you should watch this film if you haven't seen it, because it really also gears around doing something that you love, maybe not making a lot of money, but having a job for your life.
Yeah.
That is incredible.
Yeah.
And that was something that really resonated with me. These people weren't rich, but they were working at their dream job.
Yeah.
And what I really wanted to see at the end of this film was kind of like, that kind of job will fuck you up for the rest of your life, because you're in this loose atmosphere,
yeah,
of goofing off and not a lot of rules and,
yeah,
shit.
Yeah.
And now you're in, after 20 years, some of these people work there all their lives,
yeah,
are in a real work of corporate world now.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Even, yeah, if they went into the another record store or whatever, yeah, it was going to be a totally different thing. Like,
yeah,
you smell like marijuana and you're 10 minutes late.
Yeah,
you're,
yeah,
out of,
yeah,
here.
Totally.
I really wanted to see what happened to these people, because that kind of job can really fuck you up,
yeah,
later on in life.
Yeah, that, we talked about that. You know, it's so hard to whittle down 60 years of someone's, yeah, life into a 90-minute film.
I get it. You got all this footage,
and it was definitely something that I paid a lot of mind to, because they did have a difficult time adjusting. You know, Russ at that point was financially fine. He was sort of set. He actually did start another record store called R5 in Sacramento.
Oh, wow.
That was open when we first began filming. In fact, the interview that we did of him in the Tower store, the aisle is the rock section, and it's section 5 for R5. That was like my nod. And we were,
right,
going to do a whole bit about how he opened up another record store, but it fucking closed.
Right.
And, you know, there were a handful of the people that had worked for Tower that went off to 6 other different jobs, and some stuck and some didn't.
That's what I wanted to know.
Opened up a printing store. And like that, you know, it would have been fun to have been able to include all that stuff.
Kind of like at the end of movies, you know, like say Fast Times.
Oh,
Spicoli,
yeah,
went,
yes,
on the way.
Oh,
but
of
anyway,
course.
It'd be like such and such ended up working at IBM and then
of
shot
course.
Herself because, yeah, she hated it.
Yeah, 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 no, exactly. And like, look, I mean, there are a lot of the people that we spoke to in the film that have had a really hard time. And it ended up being a scenario in which we chose to sort of try to end it on a happy and uplifting note. And it really felt like the best way to sort of do it, because we really did want that film to be to celebrate how special Tower was. And the thing that I found really incredible was that there was no pity party for any of them. We're just like, it was an amazing experience. I'm so great that you know, I was lucky enough to have it. I was bummed that it ended, but like, God, how fucking lucky are we to have been able to experience that? And that sort of seemed like the better note to sort of end on, as,
yeah,
opposed to, you know, and then they opened up a print shop that then closed, yeah, or, you know, and then someone became a golf shark or yeah, something. Do you know what I mean?
I was like, just any, so any curious because I know how people can be ruined when they have great jobs all their life and then have to get into the real world, because that, when you're watching this film, the lunacy of working of for course. Us is just crazy.
But I also, you know, like the thing that, the reason why, like at the end of the day, the thing that also sort of made me go like, no, let's, we'll end with this, you know, the sort of the nostalgia, kind of happy sort of ending to a degree, but it, I also sort of used like a pop playbook where I said like, you know, leave them wanting a little bit more.
Yeah.
You leave the audience wondering what the, you know, what happened to those people.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And so I opted to sort of keep it.
You gave it the Inception top. Ending.
A little bit. Yeah.
The top.
Well, maybe it leaves room for a sequel. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. Now, of course you did the Eagles of Death Metal, documentary.
Yeah.
Which is got to be one of the most horrific events of all time.
Yeah.
And also one of the leeriest things to even touch on.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it even took me a while to watch this film because I knew what the topic was. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, man, my whole life has been concerts.
Yeah.
And even recently, I was at a... at a Dead & Co. show at the Hollywood Bowl, mm-hmm, and mid-show, four guys just walk on stage in black outfits, whisper in the band members' ears, they put their instruments down and just walked off stage.
No shit? Yeah. I didn't hear this.
Yeah, I know. It was weird. It was all low-key, and they were gone for like 10 minutes, and I was in the third row, and here comes these dog bomb sniffing dogs on stage.
No and fucking way.
A lot of people left right away because we had the Eagles of Death Metal thing. And then we had, this was 2 weeks after the London one up there, like over the summer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So
Manchester. Yeah.
Yeah. Manchester. So it was like immediately I'm spooked.
Yeah.
But then I'm thinking, well, if something happens, this is where I die. Yeah. You know what I mean? At least I'm not going to be scared to sit in my house for the rest of my life. You know, same with people that, you know, movie theater shootings and all that stuff is, it's geared around fucking spooking you. And it's like, you know, we got to live. But that is such a hairy topic, man. And, and to even approach that, man, was like, how do you, approach that in a way of like, fuck, this is so, it's so fresh.
I'll be honest. I didn't want to.
Yeah.
It was crazy, turn of events, and obviously it was really a horrible time. Everything happened really quick. Basically, so we did the tower party that the Eagles of Death Metal performed, and that was the first show of a West Coast tour that they did, and then they went to Europe
for the new record.
And so it was basically, I had been talking both with Jesse and Joshua quite a bit, as well as the Eagles management team, you know, in the month before the attack. And then they went on tour, and they had actually played Sacramento, and I wasn't able to go because I had to do a tower thing. And
were you talking to them about doing a documentary?
No. All just tower related shit.
Oh, wow.
And I've known Jesse and Josh for a long time. I've known, you know, Davey Joe as well. And so they're just friends. So, you know, I text with them and just say, hey, I'm going to be in Sacramento. You know, maybe I'll see you guys at the show. And wasn't able to meet up. And then Jesse had actually called me from, he had called me from Ireland. Because he saw there was a Tower Records in Dublin. He's like, what the fuck? This wasn't in the film.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, there's one open still?
Yeah, there's one that's completely 100% independently Irish-owned in Dublin.
Like the Japan one?
Very similar to the Japan one, but it's isolated. It's just that one.
Wow. I can't believe no one's done that with the LA one.
Trust me, I tried. Yeah. And so he was like busting my chops based on that. And so I was asking him, I said, hey, how's the tour? He's like, it's great. Just got over here to Europe. It's fucking incredible. We go to Paris. We're in Paris. Our next show's in Paris, like in a couple of days. Like, it's great. Love you. Have so much fun. Give me a shout when you're back. And then that fucking day happens, and it was, you know, horrible and shitty. And really the next sort of, you know, month and a half was really spent, you know, sort of giving their guys the space and, but reaching out to them saying, I hope you're okay. You know, if there's anything you need me to do, let me know. And that was, you know, those first 2 months or so were really sort of, you know, delicate. Basically what happened was they had done an interview with Vice, my producing partner, Sean, and their manager, one of their managers, Brian, they were out for lunch, and Sean had said, hey, I saw you guys announced you guys are, you know, picking up the European tour. You guys are going back. Is like Vice going to go with you to go do something? And he's like, no.
Yeah.
And Sean was like, that might be really interesting. You know, there may be something there.
Right.
And he had sort of brought it up to me a couple of days later, and I was instantly just like, nope, I don't want to fucking do that. I don't want to touch that. That's too.
It's sacred ground.
That's too, I mean, those are my friends. That's too raw. I don't want to do that. Plus, I'm on a TV show. Like, I can't get away. Like, the schedule is just not going to allow it.
Right.
But the more and more I thought about it, you know, I never said, like, no, we're not doing it. It was just sort of like, I don't know. No, I don't think I can do that. But the more and more it stuck in my head, the more and more I thought, you know what? There may be an opportunity to go back with them and document like the end of this chapter and everyone sort of coming together and sort of moving on with their lives and try to make something positive out of all this fucking horrible shit. And then I talked with Jesse, and Jesse's like, you have to do it. And I was like, okay. And so I started sort of asking, I had to ask permission from my boss on the Life in Pieces show. I had to like run it up the brass.
Cause what show were you on then? Fargo?
No, this was still Life in Pieces.
Oh, I mean, wow.
Because literally we were still our first season of Life in Pieces. I mean, we were a brand new show.
Wow.
But in order for me to do this, like they'd have to change the schedule around right at the end of the season when everybody is just tired and it's chaotic anyways and it's gnarly. But, you know, all these, they had all seen the band play. Like, they all knew that they were my friends. I was on set when the attacks happened. So they knew, you know, what was going on. And I said, like, look, I actually did the same thing I did when I, for Orange County. I went to the boss and I went to my boss and I said, like, look, this opportunity has come up. It's really special. It's important to me. But I have to ask for your permission, and it's totally okay if you say no. Like, yeah. I'm not going to be upset with you because I understand that there's bigger.
But I do need to ask.
But I need to ask because this is important to me, and it's important to me, like as a person. I think it's an important thing out there, and it's I want to help my friends. And he was very cool. He said, "Absolutely understand. Let me see what I can do." And he was actually able to like give me the days off. So then it was like, okay, this is serious. Let's actually try and make this happen. And around that time, I then spoke with Josh, and you know, he was very protective and he was sort of the same thing. He's like, dude, no, don't do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
but you know, we talked about it and we had both sort of come to the same conclusion, like this is actually important and this is something that maybe would be worthwhile, and it's delicate and it's really going to be hard, and there's going to be a lot of emotions, and it doesn't quite make sense. But he was like, but if anyone's going to do it, like it's you.
Right.
So good luck. And so I took that very seriously, and then it just came in down to, all right, well, we have 2.5 weeks. we need to find financing. I was able to find financing because I just had a documentary that had come out. So people are like, make, you got another documentary? And I actually called someone and said, actually, I do.
Yeah.
And I need an answer in 24 hours and was able to get financing. And before I knew it, 2.5 weeks later, we're in Paris.
How do you map out what you're going to do? Because there's a
there was no map.
Yeah, because there's a whole backstory that really makes this thing so deep and special
that
I had no idea about, you know?
That was, I'll be honest, that was a total gut. I was flying by the seat of my pants, and I pulled a page out of the Russ Solomon playbook. I just got to the point where I just said, yes, let's do it. Here's what we're going to do. Here's my idea. And the idea was, we're going to go to Paris and we're going to document the band coming back and them putting on that show. And we had arranged for a bunch of interviews with different survivors, all of whom had not told their stories to other outlets, because I didn't want to rehash all of the same stuff.
Right.
And that's not a, I'm not slagging off on the people that have told their stories
before.
Yeah,
but you want the raw emotion of somebody that hadn't told it yet.
I'd watched so much stuff and there were so many different components going on. I just said, let's just find people that haven't told their story yet that hopefully will trust us, because we had all these personal connections through the band and through some other people that are really, really close with Jesse that are from France that play in this band called Sinner Sinners. So we were able to find a bunch of people, and then we got to interview Jesse and Joshua. And I knew, because it was the first thing that was on my mind, I knew that part of the story was going to be about the fact that Joshua wasn't there and the guilt that he felt for not being there, just because I know them both really well and I know their history. And
right. People don't know, Joshua plays in Eagles of Death Metal sometimes. It started out as a side project and then it bloomed into a big band.
Yeah.
And of course, Queens of the Stone Age and everything he does in life. You know, he was like, Eagles of Death Metal, fly on your own now.
Yeah.
You know, and get out there and do it, you know?
So he plays with the band sometimes, sometimes he doesn't. And for that particular tour, Brody was pregnant, and so he didn't go. And so I knew some of that personal history, but what I did was I would do this on Tower too, is I would start off all the interviews and let's just talk about anything. Like we could just, how'd you get into whatever? How'd you meet so-and-so? Just to get people talking and comfortable. And with Jesse and with Joshua as well, it was difficult because, like, you don't ask your friends the toughest questions. You do if you have to.
Yeah, but, right. Everybody has their guard up, even on your best friend.
But there was an agreement between the three of us that we would force each other into, like, we would go together into the uncomfortable place, you know, subjects,
right?
That we would make, you know, because that's the only way that was going to work, is we had to be totally honest and open. And so I didn't want to just start the fucking interview like talking about the worst stuff. So it was just sort of like, oh, well, you know, how'd you meet Jesse? You know, where are you from? Those kinds of things. These are all things that I already sort of knew, but it was just a way to get us comfortable in this dynamic. Because normally when I'm talking with Josh, it's not with a fucking camera around.
Yeah, you know? Right.
Not with Jesse.
And he's got a lot of mystique.
But he's also nervous because he doesn't know like what's appropriate, what's not. You know, he still feels guilt that he's not there, but it's weird that he's in this document. Like, there's just a lot of really confusing stuff. And so I was just asking him about, you know, growing up in Palm Desert and all that sort of stuff and how he met Jesse. And he starts telling me all these stories, some of which that I had heard, that was really about their relationship and how close they were. And we sort of take a break, my producing partner, Sean, goes, I see what you're doing. And I go, really? Like, what the fuck am I doing? And he goes, these are our two main characters. Like, this guy is like, has this relationship with his best friend, and he's taken him under his wing, and he's always protected him. And then at the moment that he sets him free, horrible fucking thing happens, yeah. And he's trapped a world away.
It's like two brothers, and one goes to war, exactly. And the other one doesn't. You know,
and he goes, I didn't know any of this. Like, that's our film, and I go, yeah, that's exactly what I'm doing. Like, I'm just fucking making it up as I go along. But yeah. that was. What was in the back of my brain when, you know, that day when all that shit was going down, and I just didn't think about it because there was just so much other shit going on. And so that ended up sort of being the backbone for the film, and we were able to sort of bring in all of the other components and all that other stuff.
Well, that's what gives it this fucking soul and this heart, you know, because you're looking at two friends since, you know, the early days, since growing kids, up in the desert and you know, that whole thing. And what I didn't know of Jesse having a whole nother life of, he wanted to be married with kids. He wasn't a rock and roller. And all of that shit, you know, and then you find out, you're like, holy smokes, man. Not only, let's say the shooting didn't ever go down.
Yeah.
That is still... Like, I look at, like, I started comedy at 44 years old.
Yeah.
I'm 51 now. Yeah. You know what I mean? To me, that's another story right there in itself of a guy who followed his dream at a certain age. He was an older guy and started playing rock. That's a whole nother, you know, subline, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So even without the horrific thing, I was like engaged in this story of like, oh my God, you know?
Well, and that was the thing, is because we all agreed very early on, and this is every conversation I had with everyone who worked on the film, is that we didn't want it to just be about the bad stuff. We didn't want it to just be about that, because if it's just about that, it doesn't fucking mean anything.
Not at all. And you don't want to give these bastards their glory. Yeah, you know what I mean?
It's senseless, and you become so desensitized to it that it you know, I mean, it the whole project really sort of like sent me off in a very weird, very sort of interesting, you know, self, you know, needless to say, therapy has been involved, you know, because you see all of these other attacks, you know, and this was before they were also other concerts, but you'd see all these other attacks, and I really learned a lot from the people that, you know, not only the guys in the band, but the people, the survivors that we spoke to there in France, like what their experience has been like since, because we saw them, you know, 3 months after the attacks, and they were hounded by every single news organization around the world, people that were so disrespectful, just wanting to get their stories so that they could put it on a news clip so that it could then be followed by a Sprite commercial. Do you know what I mean? Like, just horrible stuff. And that's just the way that works, you know, like it's not fine, but that's just, there's not really a whole lot I could do about that. But what I could do was try and be as respectful as I could in our story and bring them in and maybe help them. And then, you know, if other survivors see the movie, you know, I didn't want it to just be about the bad shit. It needed to be about other stuff. I wanted it to be a film where you could spend some time in someone else's shoes and understand what it is that person went through, so that maybe you have a little bit of compassion when, you know, you're talking to them, or when you're thinking about that sort of stuff, or when something like fucking Manchester happens, or Vegas, or any number of these fucking things. God, I wish they'd stop. You know, but just to sort of give you a little bit more of a human connection to these things that are so surreal and emotional and weirdly obtuse that your brain has a hard time understanding it. And, you know, so many of the survivors that I've talked to, that's the thing that we're always discussing, is like, there's no one way to do this, to get through this. Everyone's just trying to do the best that they can. And the one thing that we wanted to do was to show that sense of community, of people coming together and trying to help each other get through that. And
I love those survivors.
They're amazing.
I love
every single one of those people are my fucking heroes.
I love those people, man. And it made me like cry when they, you know, when I'm watching them, I was just like shook up, man. And I was just like, I love those people, and yeah. And that they went back to the show, and you know, and they all bonded and everything.
It's, well, because it's you,
yeah.
You know, you're the guy in the front row at the concerts.
I know, man. I mean? Like, it's just like, that's what I think about. I just think about, like, God, man, you know, so many shows. You're just there at a show, and you're the in concerts. No one goes to a concert going, I'm going to this because I want to have a shitty time. You know what I mean? No one ever goes to a concert for that. They go with their friends. They want to escape the real life. And then they go to a concert and real life happens. Yeah. It's like, fuck, man.
It's hard. It's
hard. It really is.
And so, you know, it was a challenge because it was all so last minute and so sort of quick, and it was you know,
it's a masterpiece.
It's all
thing. I watched that fucking thing a few times, and I was like, this thing is, I mean, anything that can just, because it has so many stories.
Yeah.
And all the stories except for the shit main one is about love.
Yeah.
That's the incredible thing. It's like this massive thing of love. These friends love rock and roll. These two friends grew up together. These people love music. Everybody. And then this shit thing. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it's like, there's so much love in it that you're going like, fuck those dirt people, you know?
I really wanted it to be about, you know, the people coming together and celebrating and, you know, celebrating the people that unfortunately are no longer with us. And, but also, you know, taking the next steps in their lives and moving on with their lives is, you know, I think it's important. I think it's important because it's important to me.
Yep.
That doesn't get fucked with.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what I mean? And, you know, unfortunately, you know, it still is happening and still going on. And there, you know, unfortunately, it's, there are more people in that club now. And it's really hard, you know, hearing about Manchester. I mean, I'd gone on the road with Jesse and the band so that we could finally have some fun.
Right. Yeah.
And
right.
Not be talking about the movie, and had a fucking amazing time, said goodbye to Jesse. 2 days later, I get a text from him going like, hey man, I'm so glad you came out. I'm like, thank you so much. I had such a good time. 20 minutes after that, he goes, turn on the news.
Wow.
In Manchester, it happened. And so it's just this thing that, you know, unfortunately keeps happening. But, you know, I think it's really important that, you know, for lack of a better phrase, you know, we don't let the bad guys win. And
and that's what I believe in.
Just keep going. You know, the unfortunate thing is that, or one of the many unfortunate things is that, you know, things now are, it change and are different, and there are SWAT teams now at concerts and snipers and things like that. And that fucking sucks, but, I'll never not go to a concert.
That's exactly what I said.
That's just not,
you know what
that's
I mean?
Not an option.
I think that's really why I'm such a deadhead now, too. Like, I hated the Dead forever. Now I'm just like, these people are cool. Let's love.
Let's just get together and have a good time.
Yeah. I'm turning into a
let's
fucking...
Let's dance, even
I'm
if you dance
goddamn
fucking
hippie.
Horribly. Yeah. Yeah, it's a fucking circle.
You twirling bastard.
All right. I don't think that's really dancing, but yeah, you go ahead. Do that. Sure. Whatever. I'm not gonna get mad at you for that.
Dude, I can't thank you enough for doing the show.
Dude, of course.
And are you working on another project?
Not working on any docs right now. No, I sort of fucking burnt myself.
Yeah. I got one for you when we turn off the mics.
All right, we'll talk about it. I'll always listen to an idea for sure.
Yeah, but
no, like really right now, I'm just trying to be a good dad and a good husband. And, you know, I got the Life in Pieces show on CBS, so that's keeping me busy.
What day is it on?
I think it's Thursdays at 9:30. I don't know. We don't have a bunch of publicists and stuff here, so normally this is where someone would say like, the show is on at this time. But I'm pretty sure it's Thursdays at 9:30. But yeah, that's kind of it right now.
And then
if you have kids and they want to see that Jumanji movie, I'm like in a split second of the Jumanji movie.
There you go. It's great that you're you know, you're into cool shit, and you know what I mean, because you could easily have been some rich kid and just been like, you know, like just no taste, fucking, you know what I mean?
Well, this is when I say, remember, like I was a small kid when he was on Bosom Buddies, so that's a pretty fucking surreal thing. So, yeah. Like, yeah, yeah, that's a good, I always look for the equalizer. I call it the humbler. I tried to convince Jesse to write a song about it. He almost did too, but he couldn't find any other, too many other words that rhyme with humbler.
Yeah.
But I always look for, like, when you're in a surreal scenario, you know, like you're at a press junket or a big premiere or whatever, I try and find, like, the one thing that, like, should humble you. You
yeah.
know, like, basically, like, the guy that's, like, off in the corner looking at his phone and doesn't give a shit what's going on. Like, I'm like, oh, that's the humbler. I'm just constantly looking for the humbler. What's the thing that just, like, yeah, don't, yeah, sit down.
Yeah.
Not too exciting. Nothing too special. Kids are really the humbler. That's
that's fucking cool, though. Two generations of fucking, you know, great, great talent, man. And The Thing You Do is one of the greatest ever.
Oh, that's a good movie. Yeah.
Come on, man.
That's a good movie.
All right, man.
All right, dude.
You got Instagram or anything?
I'm on the Instagram and the Twitter sometimes. Find me. COLINHANKS.
See these damn films, man. Go on iTunes and watch this Tower Records. And then The Eagles of Death Metal is on. Is that still on Netflix?
No, it was on HBO. HBO. Now I'm not sure. I'm not sure where it is now streaming, but it's on. You can get it. Shout just released a great DVD of it, Blu-ray. So it's on there. So you can Amazon it. And that'll be on Netflix eventually. Netflix is where things like end up.
I love both those films, and it's great because I've had all the Eagles guys on. I've had Joshua on. I've had you on. I just love having the whole thing. You know what I mean? It's just
anybody
around that camp seems to be into good shit,
and they're all
isn't that amazing?
They're all good people.
Yeah,
they're all good people.
All right, thanks for tuning in, guys. Keep leaving a review and subscribe on iTunes, and keep the candles lit. See ya.